Everyone, it's Eugene, and welcome to another edition of Forensics Talks. This is going to be episode 86, and my guest today is Roberto King. So, Dr. Roberto King, he's the Vice President of Product at Foster & Freeman in the UK, overseeing the company's product innovation and development portfolio. Previously, he was the Chief Technology Officer, and that's where I first met him. Roberto gained a first-class honors degree in chemistry and sports science from Loughborough University in 2005, and he completed his PhD in chemistry 4 years later at the same institution. He's a versatile inorganic chemist with experience in the application of chemistry within the forensic arena, and his background involves the development of novel fingerprint-enhancing agents for use on troublesome substrates, as well as investigation into unique methodologies for evidence recovery from document-based evidence. His current research interests involve finger marks, body fluids, question document examination, trace evidence, and contact transfer, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about some of these topics for sure. And he's published a whole bunch of papers, more than 25 research papers, three book chapters, and he's appeared on numerous television broadcasts. He's lectured, and he's been even a presenter at the Forensic Photography Symposium that I held in January. And he did a talk on visualizing blood, and I remember it was actually quite a technical talk and really great information for those of you that were there. Now, we've had some past discussions on 3D document analysis, both Roberto and I and some of his team, and I really think it's an interesting area. And so when I saw recently that a paper came out, I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk about some of the work that he was doing and maybe where he's going in this area. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to bring Roberto in. There he is. Hi there, Roberto.
Hey. Hey, Eugene. Good, thanks. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you again for talking at the Forensic Photography Symposium.
Yeah, it seems like a long time ago, actually, but it wasn't really.
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. Well, I usually start guests on their background because I'm often curious about how people got to where they were. If we wind the clock back before Roberto was in university and he was trying to figure out what he was trying to do, were you one of those techie kids, or were you
No, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. My primary focus when I was kind of going through sort of the last years of school here was sport. I was kind of mad on sport. Anything that would involve getting out and being competitive, that was kind of where my interest lay. And I was naturally kind of I guess interested in science, but more so from an application perspective rather than understanding the theory behind it all. And in the UK, Loughborough University is, known for being, world leading as a sports institution, and they excel in various aspects of science and engineering and IT, but sports science is really where they're kind of known across the world. And so for me, it was, I wanted to do sports science and I wanted to do it at Loughborough University. That kind of developed a little bit into me taking on a joint honours program and with chemistry as kind of the other discipline. I won't bore you with the details as to how that came about, but it did. And my primary kind of ambition was to get into the university, start studying both, and then if I wanted to make the transfer directly to sports science, then I would have done so. But I wanted to keep my options open. And then I kind of got into the after the first semester, and first semester of university is always difficult, right? It's a steep learning curve. You're into the big wide world, right? And I ended up really enjoying the chemistry that I was being taught. And I think for me, the fundamental difference between learning chemistry or science at school and learning at university was the way that it was being taught to me. And I learned a lot during those few years, and it's something that I like still to this day I'm really passionate about in terms of outreach, engagement, promoting science, getting people interested at a young age. It's something that I do sort of regularly, as regularly as possible, go to sort of local schools, outreach events, and try and just talk a little bit about the fundamentals of science and how they all apply. But anyway, digress a little bit, but I kind of had a bit of a I developed a bit of a spark for chemistry, and I turned out to be relatively good at it, I guess. And I enjoyed the practical side of things, and got to the end of the 3 years. I did the joint honours, and I did pretty good in my degree. And there was an opportunity for a PhD studentship. And of course, I was kind of like many in my situation, come to graduation year, what am I going to do? I don't really know what I want to do. But everyone around me was saying the more qualifications you can get, the better. It stands you in better stead. So PhD opportunity came around. Inorganic chemistry. Okay. I enjoy inorganic chemistry. Let's have a go at that. So I then started a PhD in inorganic chemistry. And my remit for that PhD was actually to explore some applications of some main group chemistry. And it had nothing to do with forensic science at all. And we were sort of working on a project actually looking at developing a material that could detect ammonia. And one of the interesting properties with this particular material was that it was actually a superconductor at low temperature. And it formed these really quite intricate molecular wires of two molecules, sulfur and nitrogen. And our idea after the sort of ammonia sensor project didn't really work out was to, well, what about if we can look at incorporating these molecular wires into something inert, and you're creating these insulating molecular wires. And the idea with that, or the application drive at the time, was kind of miniaturization of electronic devices, right? And so we started doing that, and we had some really good success. But this is where I fell into forensics pretty much by accident. Was the material that we were using is deployed as a vapor gas under a vacuum atmosphere. And we were finding that we were developing fingerprints on all of our glassware that we've been using. And it was actually, in the first few instances, it was more of an annoyance because we couldn't actually see inside the reaction vessel. But we ended up kind of just digging into literature because, you know, this was about 2006. And 2006, we were there kind of thinking, well, surely no one's interested in fingerprint processes. Like, fingerprints have been used for hundreds of years, right? And why would there be an interest? But there was more and more being published. And I remember seeing quite an intricate paper that was talking about SEM analysis of developed finger marks. And it was in quite a high-profile journal, and thought, actually, there's maybe more to this. And it was then really, didn't really have much of an experience in forensic science. It wasn't the CSI, Miami, CSI, Vegas thing that it is now. It was, you know, it was sort of, it was kind of just coming into the sort of TV realms. And so it was a steep learning curve. We engage with people at the UK Home Office, people in the sort of UK Defence Laboratory. And we realized that we had something actually that could potentially be quite powerful. And so the next however many years to where we are now, kind of my journey developed from researching what was fundamental chemistry to applying that, I guess, coincidental observation to a forensic challenge. And that then moved on to me kind of getting a real passion for that and wanting to make a difference. And I think that's key. It's, yes, I'm really keen on engaging and promoting and talking about all things kind of science or forensic science, but I'm also keen on what we do in terms of our research and now at Foster and Freeman product development and making a difference in the real world. And I think that's why I ultimately moved from the academic environment, where I was absolutely enjoying researching and developing research and working and developing people that were working in my research team as I grew through the ranks a little bit. But I wanted to see that transition. And that's often where a lot of these kind of great ideas kind of fall over, is that kind of valley of death between great mm-hmm. idea, we can prove the concept, but what about actually productizing it and getting it used in anger? So yeah, that in a nutshell, that's a little bit about my background.
Yeah, I think, one thing that strikes me about you, and I'm the same way, is that you're not a one-trick pony and that you have a diverse interests in many different areas. And I think that's always helpful when a person is a generalist. I shouldn't say that, but you're actually specialized in many areas, but you know, you borrow from one place and you bring something
that's right.
together.
I would say, my passion really, where my heart is in fingerprints. I think that largely because that's where it all started. But there is so much with forensics where you're absolutely right. You borrow from one discipline that might be on the fringes of what we would call forensic science, and you adapt it and you see opportunity. And it's difficult sometimes to see how potentially something quite abstract can be kind of molded and formed to have real world application in the discipline that we work in. So, every day is different, and there are different challenges, whether it be fingerprints, whether it be question documents, whether it be crime scene. I guess the state of the forensic landscape is changing a lot. It has started to change, and it certainly will accelerate at pace with the introduction of cyber terrorism, cyber threat, digital forensics. These are areas that are exploding at pace now. And, that's outside of my immediate comfort zone, but it's certainly something I've got an interest in. So again, keen to see how maybe there are some synergies there.
Yeah. Your introduction to Foster and Freeman, though, was that while you were in school or was it right after you graduated?
No. I mean, I was aware of Foster and Freeman whilst I was doing my PhD. We actually worked with them to some degree in looking at trying to productize the technique that we were working on. But it was one of those situations where the process was being used operationally by UK Ministry of Defence. And so it was something that needed to actually, at that moment in time, not develop any further beyond their operational capacity. But that was my introduction to Foster and Freeman. And then it kind of came back around full circle. We ended up developing the product a few years ago now. And that's the Recover product that we spoke briefly about before we came on air. That was my introduction to Foster and Freeman. And, I think once you start digging into the physical forensic sciences and forensic technology and forensic technology manufacturers and suppliers, then Foster and Freeman are one of those companies, one of those organizations that have presence. And for me, it was the natural kind of progression in my career anyway, and it was at the right time to do so.
So what position did you begin with in Foster Freeman? What was your initial role?
So I started as an R&D application specialist, a research and development application specialist. And it's quite funny because I remember having some early discussions when I started at Foster and Freeman. Again, big step into the big wide world. You're not in the academic bubble anymore. You're in the sort of, the commercial, the industrial bubble. And, what was my remit at that time? Well, actually, we were a relatively small organization. When I joined, I think there were about 80 something people in the business. Just to put that into perspective, we're about 160 now. I've been there 9 years, so we've developed pretty well. And there wasn't, we had a couple of chemists, we had a couple of physicists. Everything that we do at Foster and Freeman is done in-house. We don't outsource stuff. We have our own research and development department, and that's where I was embedded within. And we had access to a chemistry lab, and that basically became my kind of lair, my little chamber. And I just tinkered in there, and I was working on fingerprint stuff. And interestingly, at the time, as I mentioned a few moments ago, it's always important to keep an eye on the landscape and understand what challenges are coming down the track. At the time, in the UK, we were due to be moving over to polymer currency, which I know in Canada you guys have had polymer currency for a number of years. And one of the biggest challenges that we had, or the UK police forces had, the forensic force teams had, was how do we develop fingerprints on this new currency? Because we've kind of honed our processes for the paper-based materials that we've had for years, And now we're having this polymer currency. What do we do? Well, yes, you can look to the likes of Canada and Australia, who are, I guess, they were world leaders in putting that technology in place, putting polymer currency in circulation, but also developing the infrastructure behind it, for, not only from the bank manufacturers and all of their technology, their ATMs, but also the policing processes and looking at that. But the difference with the UK scenario was that we were using an entirely different type of polymer material. So the base material was completely different, which meant that the coatings and the inks and the pigments and everything else was all entirely new. So it was a really steep learning curve. So for me, that I saw that as a really good opportunity to say, well, okay, we've got something that's coming in the next year or so. We know that we need to have a better understanding of what fingerprint processes we can use. There was question document stuff as well that we also got involved with, where, you know, what are the optical properties of these things? But actually, what are the challenges there with developing fingerprints on banknotes, but also on polymer banknotes? And we then developed actually a range of two independent fingerprint powders that have unique properties where they fluoresce in the infrared part of the spectrum. And the benefit there is that you don't have any background interference. And that's one of the biggest challenges that you have when trying to get good ridge detail from currency that has these really intricate patterns in the background. You have fluorescent security features. So that was something that I got my teeth into straight away. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I got to work quite closely with the Bank of England and got access to some of these notes before they even went into circulation. So that was really cool, you know, coming out of the academic environment straight into that. I was an R&D application specialist, and I was working on pretty much any kind of bits of research that needed to be done to help support or bring a product through from, it might have been blue sky kind of concepts, or it might have just been evolutionary productization, but they were the kind of projects that I was working on.
Well, see, I mean, you were CTO and then you moved into your current role, which was product. So, which I can see a lot of relationship, like there's some close overlap there. So as your current role right now, how deep are you able to get into each of the different products? I mean, is it more like sort of driving it from a high level, or how deep do you get?
It's one of those where you'd love to be able to be really, really close to absolutely everything. As always, it's having the bandwidth to do that. I think so for me, I kind of sit above that and try and drive it in the right direction. But that requires kind of having understanding of our existing product roadmap, our product portfolio, understanding what emerging technologies in other areas may enable us to do certain things within our sphere. It enables us to get really close and have really good relationships with end users to understand what their challenges are. It requires us to understand regulatory changes that might be happening in certain jurisdictions. So, you know, the introduction of things like ISO 17025 or 17020, that means that we need to change the way that we develop product, because there's going to be a need from the end users to be able to do things in a much more controlled manner and a reliable and repeatable manner. But it also involves us keeping an eye on the research that's going on and seeing what other people are doing, because quite often the trends in certain sectors can help you understand where some of the challenges are, because quite often the research that's being done is being funded, and the reason the funding is there is because there's a challenge that needs to be solved. So I try and stay as close as possible to things. I mean, generally speaking, we will develop as a company, we'll probably launch a couple of products a year. The pandemic was a really interesting time, not obviously for everyone, but for us, when we develop products, we're not necessarily just developing one product and then we move on to another. We're sort of co-developing, and they'll be at different stages. Now, when the pandemic came through, we had about three or four projects on the agenda, and our focus really during that pandemic was to get those finished. So we launched three or four products in a relatively short space of time. But generally speaking, we will try and launch one to two products a year. So that means that can be a lot closer to them, can kind of support them in a bit more of an intimate way, if you will, and then work with ensuring, because the job isn't just about having the ideas, developing the products, launching it, and then starting the next. It's also about support. In some respects, it's more important to support that introduction into the marketplace. And so really my transition from CTO, where I was overseeing all of the research and understanding the way that research could funnel into new product development, in some respects, that the work that you do today, you see the benefits of that 3, 4, 5 years down the line. Moving into the role I'm in at the minute, it's trying to disseminate that knowledge, the power of some of the new technologies, with the end users. And the end user isn't always the person that's using the product. It's sometimes the people that are in the procurement agencies that need to understand what the business case is for a particular technology. If it's going to save me time, is it going to give me higher reproducibility? Is it going to be more reliable? All those kind of things. So it's trying to work as closely as possible and have this kind of customer centric approach to everything that we do. And that's really important. And being connected on Teams, on Zoom, all these kind of things that the pandemic brought with it, has enabled us to have these conversations and have these dialogues a lot more readily.
Yeah, the transfer of information during that time has been incredible. And just before the pandemic, I was sort of already transitioning into doing online training and such. So when it hit, it was incredible. Like the response, yeah. I think June of 2020, you could have had a course on basket weaving. Everybody was on board. People were buying online courses. It was budget for training and everything else. So
I think I said to you yesterday, when we sort of went into lockdown, we were the first kind of organization within our particular market sector to try our hands at webinars. And it was actually something that we'd wanted to do for a number of years, but it was kind of, I'm not sure that will really take on, and maybe it will, maybe it won't. But then we were forced into it, because at the end of the day, when you are an organization that ultimately relies on selling product, right, then you have to find ways to get out there and engage. And so we decided to do our first webinar in June 2020. And I remember it so clearly. I remember being in our demo room, and we had two webcams, and we tried to do live presentation, live demo with scientific equipment. You know, it's never going to go quite as you wish. I remember doing it, and we had about 90 people on, and I was amazed. That's 90 people that we had a captive audience with for an hour. And people may have tried to dial into the basket weaving course and got us accidentally, but it was great to actually have that dialogue with people. And it's something that we've stuck with, and now if anyone's dialed into any of our webinars, they're much more polished, and we have a live Q&A section at the end, which personally is always the best bit for me, because it's great to field that feedback and hear what some of the questions and try and sort of answer them as best as possible. We don't always have the answers, right? But we certainly try to find them out if we don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. The interaction is a great part, when you can sort of, when it's not just one way and you can get feedback, which is great. I want to knock off a couple of things off of the list here. And because there's four areas here when I go under products, and it was a good way to sort of approach this. So I want to circle back to question documents after the other three. And so can you give me just a couple minutes on what you guys are doing right now with trace evidence analysis? I see a number, Raman Spectra, you got Forum, you got some other things there. So just maybe give me a summary of what you guys are doing in there, and then we'll go on to fingerprints, forensic light sources, and we'll knock off question documents.
Yeah, so trace evidence is one aspect of what we do. There are four main value streams that you've got up on the screen there. Within the sort of trace evidence product line, we have systems that allow us to do analysis of things like fibers, glass fragments. So you may have heard of a technique called glass refractive index measurements, or GRIM. That's a technique that was developed by Foster and Freeman. It allows you to look at the refractive index of glass, match a particular fragment of glass to another source elsewhere. So we have, within our trace evidence product portfolio, we have a GRIM set up. We do Raman spectroscopy as well. So we have a few different offerings on laboratory benchtop Raman spectrometers. What different uses and applications we get involved from a question document side of things, we know that they're used for the analysis of inks, toners, different things that may be on printed surfaces. But they can also be used for looking at things like minerals and soils and whatnot. And then we have an FFTA, which is our kind of, our flagship trace evidence system, which allows you to do pretty much anything that you would need to do that uses a microscope. So microspectrophotometry, I said the glass refractive index measurements, you can do polarization microscopy. So, you know, it's for the more advanced, the more advanced laboratory that requires to have that higher level of interrogation down to the sort of microscopic size.
On the fingerprint side, you've got imaging systems, you got fuming systems, and you said, you know, you have some novel techniques, I think, with powders and stuff. So can you give me a summary, of what you're doing?
Our fingerprint technologies really break into two main areas. One is finger mark enhancement. So that would be, we've got to develop the fingerprints. And so one of the products that we're sort of synonymous with is cyanoacrylate fuming, which is sort of evaporating super glue. And that's probably one of the most longest standing techniques for fingerprint enhancement. So we develop cabinets for that. We also have some novel techniques, like you mentioned, when I spoke about Recover, but we've also got the infrared fingerprint powders. And then once you've developed these fingerprints, well, you need to image them. And fingerprint imaging is an art in its own right. It's great if you've got a black finger mark on a white piece of paper, but when you haven't, it gets a little bit more interesting. So we have imaging workstations from more automated, simple to use, to much more advanced kind of pro grade SLR camera driven systems as well.
Okay. On the light source side, I mean, you have a bunch of stuff there. And I know that when you did the presentation, you talked a lot about, you know, infrared and things that fluoresce and all kinds of stuff like that. So, and I see the crime light, there's a whole bunch of things. So, give me a quick summary of the
front. Yeah. So Foster and Freeman, and crime light are two words that you often hear. They go hand in hand. We were the first company that introduced an LED based forensic light source. Before that, people were using things like xenon arc lamps, halogen lights. They were filtering the light. The problem you have with that, of course, is that the intensity in output at day one is different to intensity at day two, day three, day four. You don't have the ability to finely filter the light in the same way that you do an LED. So when the LEDs came onto the market in the late 90s, it was something that we thought, there's actually some application here. And so we actually took that on, and we developed the crime light, and that's kind of gone on from single LEDs to really, really intense 16 LED, really high output intensity handheld light sources. We developed a laser product that we launched a year ago as well. So taking something that would be the size of a small suitcase, which would be your archetypical lasers, to something that is handheld, really portable, untethered, battery powered, to the crime scene. And then I guess that's really culminated in the Crime Light Auto, which is taking all of our Crime Light technology and know-how and all of our imaging expertise and putting it all together and having a handheld system that you can take out to a crime scene, use a range of multispectral imaging across the spectrum, UV, visible, infrared, capture the image, send it onto an app, and then send it straight back to the laboratory. So, you know, times have changed. The practitioner needs have changed, and the requirements to do things methodically, record things as you go, is driven the evolution of that particular technology. So, yeah, that's been a really interesting journey over the last 10 years, I'd say.
Now, with all these products, and even with the question document examination area, are you doing? Is it pretty much products, or are you doing services as well?
In terms of,
For example, somebody's got a difficult, like a case.
Yeah, no, we generally don't, I say generally, we don't do anything like that in-house. We have supported in instances where, a particular technology might be required for a particular case. There was a cold case actually in the US where, We used the Recover technology on an item of evidence that was from that. That was a 38-year-old cold case. And we developed the mark that actually identified the individual. And that was, you know, that was an instance where it was, well, we haven't got anything else. We've tried everything. We've heard about this technology. Can we give it a go? And so we did. And it's good to work really closely with forces, you know, on the front line to give them some product where they need it, when they need it, and try and support it in that way.
Okay. So on the question documents, again, there's three areas here. And under the laboratory systems, actually, I'll bring it up here. Let's talk about the ESDA2. That's one product. And there's an interesting case here. Can you talk about the case that where you use this particular instrument?
So the ESDA, or the ESDA, stands for Electrostatic Detection Apparatus. And that is pretty much the product that started Foster and Freeman back in the late 70s. So the company was officially formed in 1978. And an interesting background, because this product is synonymous with question document examination. Every question document laboratory will have an ESDA in there. The process, as it's used today, is primarily for developing indented writing on paper. So when you're writing with a pen, obviously several sheets below that, you can't see any visible indentations for the most part. The ESDA has the ability to reveal those indentations. Now, when that product, when the research was going into this particular product in the 70s by the company owners, Doug Foster and Bob Freeman, they were working on a project for the London College of Printing. And their project scope was to develop a non-contact technique for developing fingerprints on fabrics. And they came up with this electrostatic approach, and it didn't really work for developing fingerprints on fabrics. It does work at developing fresh fingerprints on some surfaces, but for the most part, it kind of failed in what it set out to do. But what they did find, again, one of these kind of serendipitous observations, was that they were able to develop these indentations. And they then worked quite closely with the UK police. And as you've got on the screen there, the very first case in the late 70s was a bank robbery in London, and there was a note that was handed over to the bank teller, and the police ended up taking that note and using this ESDA process, which wasn't a technology at the time. It wasn't something that had been launched, and they actually developed some indentations that was basically a letter to somebody in Canada pleading with them to send money to an address in Surrey in the UK. The police then went to that address and found the person that had committed this particular robbery. So that was the moment whereby Doug Foster and Bob Freeman realized they had something pretty powerful, and they developed the ESDA. They started building it from their garage in their hometown in London, and the company really sort of formed off the back of that. So question document examination really started Foster and Freeman. It's at the very heart of what we do. But as you say, the way that forensics work is you borrow technologies from certain areas to apply them in others, and we've branched out as a function of that to those four value streams that you mentioned.
Okay. So what do these VSC instruments do for you?
Okay. So the VSC is a video spectral comparator. And there are a range of VSCs from the more entry level, or the more basic in terms of functionality, to what you've got on the screen there on the left-hand side, the VSC 8000HS. That's our sort of flagship VSC system. They allow the examiner, whether it be on the front line, whether it be a secondary or tertiary examination in the sort of back offices or in a QDE laboratory, to analyze suspect documents, identity cards, anything that you can fit in that sort of inside the actual unit. We can examine it with a range of light sources, a range of different imaging techniques and technologies, and it allows you to confirm authenticity, to look for any fraudulent activity, any kind of obliterations, anything suspect that may have happened to a document. is what the VSC is really designed to do. You know, you have banks use them for authenticating and looking at security features in banknotes, for example. But it's a really powerful tool that just allows you to take a piece of evidence, generally something that's flat, and interrogate it optically and kind of learn from it. And it's a video spectral comparator. The idea being that you compare it to a known standard or something that you believe to be true.
Okay, great. So with different wavelengths, you may be able to separate one type of ink versus another something. So
a classic example is a check that's been written. We don't really do checks anymore, right? But a check has been written for a certain amount and then someone's added an extra zero on the end of it. Well, with the VSC, quite often, whilst the inks visibly may look the same, blue ink, black ink, red ink, whatever, when you illuminate them at different parts of the spectrum, there are some very fine differences that you can often see in terms of their fluorescence, in terms of their absorption or their reflection. And the VSC allows you to differentiate those and to sort of say, okay, something's gone on here. Similar sort of example is deeds of a house or a will. If pages have been inserted, there are things that you can look for in terms of the typeset or in terms of the spacing, you know, different fluorescent properties of the actual of the inks or of the actual paper itself. And that's where the VSCs really come into their own. And we have a range of them because we appreciate the fact that if you're, for example, immigration and you're sort of frontline border inspection, you need a different set of tools in a small footprint than you might have when you're kind of back in the laboratory where you need as much as you can possibly have at your disposal.
A while back we had a discussion about, you know, using 3D technologies for like question documents and stuff like that. And so I'm curious about how, you know, what first prompted your interest in that particular area, because I know there are some papers out there and I've had some other guests talking about question documents and there's just been a little bit of work in that area, but it seems relatively new that there's still a lot of work to be done in that particular field.
Yeah, I think historically we have developed ways to allow the end user to observe and interrogate three-dimensional features. Now, you know, when we look at images, forensic images, there we see a two-dimensional representation of something, but we live in a three-dimensional world, and so you know it's true to say that when you interrogate things on the z-axis, there's probably more another layer of information, another dimension of information that's there to be had. And what we've tried to do as VSC technology has evolved is develop complementary lighting that has allowed us to get the best out of that three-dimensional profile. Now, you know, we all know that there are tactile features on identity cards and passports and stuff. We can feel them. We need to be able to image them. And that's quite difficult sometimes. You know, you rely on, when you've got a camera above something, you rely on effectively illuminating it in a way that gives you low lights and highlights and everything in between. And we developed the technology to a point where we were able to do that pretty well. Side lighting is really effective, catch illumination, all these kind of tools and tricks. But more recently, we introduced a process called photometric stereo. And photometric stereo is effectively, in its simplest terms, where you illuminate from different angles all the way around a particular subject. So you have the subject in the middle and you illuminate all the way around. And you can do that at different parts of the spectrum. But what that does is it creates, in that instance there, so the limited sign, you can see that the image in the middle there is, each one of those is a snapshot from an illumination at a different angle. And when you build that composite image, you can get all of that detail come together to the image on the right. So that's where we had got up to with the 3D imaging within the VSCs. And it was a really, really powerful tool. And when we launched it only a couple of years back, people were seeing some really impressive results from it. But I guess the question then is, well, where's the application? Like how do we relate what we're seeing? Yes, it's nice to have these great images. How do we relate that to a particular forensic challenge. And that's really what this paper tried to address a little bit more, because we had within our own sort of research and development team done quite a lot of applications exercises looking at the power of photometric stereo. And we were aware that actually one of the longest standing challenges for question document examiners is intersecting lines. So where you have two pen strokes, to understand the sequence of those lines is really, really quite difficult. And there are instrumental techniques that are highly sophisticated using seriously expensive equipment that can, to some extent, give you some degree of objectivity. But it's not in the platform or the kind of entity that question document examiners are used to using. And so we wanted to try and delve a little bit deeper into the application of photometric stereo, because we had seen that we could see some pretty significant differences that allowed us to say, you know, in a blind study, you could quite easily discern which there was the first stroke and which was the second. So what we tried to do with this particular piece of work was say, okay, well, we know photometric stereo has some benefits to forensic science in terms of the analysis question documents. There are other applications as well. But actually, let's try and put that into some sort of context in terms of the applications that you might have and where it can come in useful. And then building on from that, this particular paper then took things a little bit further in terms of another type of imaging, which is elastomeric sensor imaging, which was kind of a completely abstract utilization of a piece of technology which I'd happened to have seen whilst, I think, trawling LinkedIn, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'd seen that there was this technology, this elastomeric sensor imaging, that was being used for the analysis of surface defects on different metals. So during the manufacturing process, wanting to ensure that you had a particular grain pattern or what have you. And the resolution and the sensitivity seemed to be really high. But one of the things that interested me and the guys that we were working with on this project was that you were able to use that particular modality to give you a degree of quantification. Now, photometric stereo is very good at seeing these differences and presenting them as what you've got on the screen, which is like a bump map where you can mm-hmm. see the 3D relief pattern. But it's harder to discern depth. And what we were trying to establish with this paper was, is what we're seeing with photometric stereo, where you can clearly see that there are differences in pressure points and depths, is that directly related, as we suspected, to quantifiable measurements? And our plan was to use the elastomeric sensor imaging on the GelSight product to kind of complete that kind of hypothesis, if you will. And so we used the two different technologies in a complementary manner to kind of prove that actually, yes, that is the case. And it was a really interesting piece of work. You know, obviously couldn't have done it without the co-authors, who to some extent have a lot more experience in question document and the analysis of this kind of data than I do. But it was good to kind of take something that you kind of think, well, actually, that's got a really interesting application for the automotive industry, but I can really see some benefits for forensic science, and let's have a little bit of a look at it.
Yeah, photometric stereo, I knew this from a while ago in some research, is that it's really good for very fine details, but it's often prone to distortions over larger areas. That's why people don't use it for like very big models or whatever. Right? It just has to be a very small area. So, and I noticed in your paper, you did mention that what you call like low frequency distortions and things like that. But GelSight, I had known about from Cadre Forensics. They use it for ballistics or for, you know, cartridge cases and things. And so it's an interesting technology, but it is a contact technology. So,
That's one of the things that, you know, with any piece of research that you present, it's important to kind of discuss it from all angles and talk about the strengths, weaknesses, limitations, applications. And I think one of the things that we did kind of conclude with that particular technique in its current form, and there are some thoughts about how it could be exploited in a different way, was that because you were making contact with the sample, We did have questions as to how, from a repeatability perspective, if you did 10 scans, would it look the same on the 10th as it does on the first? Because you're naturally depressing the particular sample. So I think it will really depend on what you're looking at. But we also saw in some instances where we were looking at specific inks, we were seeing that we were getting some transfer onto the bottom of the gel pad that's on the bottom of that device. So we obviously had to clean it off. And so there are obviously where you can be non-contact is better.
So how much pressure are you actually putting on the device or the gel?
So it was a bit of a trial and error kind of approach, and we ended up kind of doing it almost to feel. There comes a point where, certainly with the samples that we were looking at, you can press harder and harder, but you don't see any further changes to the values that were coming out, and that was kind of our set point. I believe that the application that Cadre Forensics are using for their ballistics examination, they apply a fixed pressure, which is absolutely the right way to go about it, because then you can be sure that you've got that reliability and that repeatability. The problem, of course, is it's a contact process, so you're going to have contact transfer, then you get into the realms of, well, cross-contamination, DNA, et cetera, et cetera.
Is the gel, I'll just call it a gel pad, I'm not sure what it's properly termed, but is it something that is, good for, hundreds of scans or hundreds of...
Yeah, it depends. It depends on the particular application and the pressure that's being used. They have a high sensitivity and a low sensitivity gel. So it's, a different chemical composition. But you're right, it is a gel pad, and it's got a silver coating on one side. And it's good for hundreds into the thousands of applications, depending on what you're doing with it. But it can be cleaned down in between runs, and they're relatively cheap, I think, to replace the consumable side of things.
Okay. So let me ask you, so you've got the photometric stereo, you've got the gel site system, the elastomeric this gel pad or whatever. So what was the test that you performed with each of these, and what did each of the results show?
So what you've got on the screen there was our starting point. We if you just maybe scroll up a little. Yeah, we had a donor basically write their signature. I think we did it sort of 8 times. But two of those instances, we asked them to do the signature in reverse. And we did that at different points across that. We didn't just do that right at the end. We did it kind of in the middle of the sequence of 8, because we wanted to interrupt the kind of regularity of the process. And quite obviously, just from looking at these, you can see which two have been done as the unnatural method. But that wasn't the point of this work. It wasn't, an experienced question document examiner would easily be able to say, well, that one there is not an authentic signature. But what we were trying to show was when you're kind of doing things in a certain reliable, repeatable manner, you get certain grooves and different formations on the paper. When that changes, then so does the three-dimensional effects that you're imparting on the actual surface. And so we got one of the guys to do this signature. We then analyzed it. As you can see here, this is with photometric stereo. And you can clearly see that. And what we were looking for was the changes at the intersections, or changes where there's a discontinuation of the flow of the stroke. So where you're going up and then straight down, we were interested in those particular areas. And what we found was, as we suspected, that we were getting complete differences at the intersections where the lines crossed, and we were getting a difference in the depth profile was being carved out into the paper, or where the signature was being done in reverse.
Interesting. And
that was with the photometric stereo, and then so we have the images there, and then we then took those intersections and we looked at them with the gel site, so that we could understand quantifiably the difference in the depth profile. So there you can see the gel site images of those particular areas. And below each of those is an actual, it's effectively a surface profile. And you can quite clearly see the jump where the paper goes into the pen. And we were able to kind of, I guess, substantiate our photometric stereo findings with the elastomeric sensor imaging findings as well. That was the starting point of the work. And then we did some other work looking at the sequence of pen ink with toner that was printed on. So can you tell whether it's quite hard optically sometimes to discern whether a pen stroke is above or below an area of toner? And so this example here, we were able to differentiate the two because we could see the difference in depth profile between when the toner was applied on top of the pen stroke or when the toner was applied below the pen stroke. It gave you a completely different profile.
Now, again, we're talking about the profile. You look at that cross section when you cut across it or whatever. And I think that's really an important part is you can quantify it now because you can say, hey, look, if we compare, you know, five samples together, you know, we get this repeatable sort of you know, within some tolerance of these profiles. And so that doesn't seem like something that has really been presented that way before, or has it? Maybe I'm wrong.
People have it's been looked at, but certainly in terms of what we were trying to do here was actually have something which is relatively accessible. We did some work with the University of Kent a couple of years back, and we're doing a similar bit of work really where we were looking at three-dimensional imaging of question documents, but we were using a technique called optical coherence tomography, or OCT. Now that's typically, you'll see that at the optometrist when you go and have a scan of the retina, because it's generally used for imaging biological tissue and getting layers through biological tissue and building up a 3D profile of what that looks like. And we wondered whether we could use OCT to interrogate question documents in the third dimension. And we actually published a piece of work looking at polycarbonates, and the on identity cards, you get layers of polycarbonates. And we were able to show the way that security fibers are embedded within that particular, in the polycarbonate layers. So whereas when you just have a two-dimensional image, you would just see the fiber appearing, we were now able to show where it actually appears in the third dimension as well. So people have looked into other ways of getting three-dimensional information from question documents, but I would say that this is probably the first bit of work that's really allowed it to be accessible, quantifiable, and actually put into context with optical measurements meeting up with quantifiable measurements on the other side as well.
Yeah, I know working in other areas, for example, we have a project going on where we have some interns looking at footwear impressions, like in sand or whatever. And so the documentation part is usually the easy part. So you can scan it in different methods and use whatever. But then the analysis part is the tricky part. And, you know, trying to find the right analysis method to give you the correct answer is often difficult. And there's often a lot of problems with distortion and different things, especially in the case of like a shoe where the shoe can flex and then the impression can bend. And so you have these distortions where you have to compare.
Laser profiling is something that has been used for that particular application, but it's also been tried out. And I think we reference a paper or a couple of papers in this where they've used 3D laser profilers. But again, it's more about the you know, we want to, I think one of the things we're quite mindful of at Foster and Freeman is developing technologies that not only solve a problem, but actually are able to be implemented within solutions that people are already used to using. Because when you have that natural kind of workflow, to add an extra tool into it is so much easier than having a standalone system that perhaps does, you know, one or two particular things. It's not going to get the use that something like a VSC will. Now, obviously, there's commercial trade-offs that need to be made, because, you know, the more you put into something, obviously, the higher the price of those of the particular components are, but also the complexity goes up significantly. So, you know, there are always trade-offs that need to be made. But for the most part, that's kind of what we're trying to achieve with all elements of research that we do. But I think the fact that we are doing the research, we're more than open to engaging with collaborations. I mentioned about the work with University of Kent. We couldn't have done that work because we didn't have an OCT system, but we had the idea to use that particular technology for a particular challenge. So, you know, we enjoy kind of embarking on those kind of voyages, and it's really important for us to publish the work that we do, because not just for the, you know, for the people that are involved in the work, you know, and ultimately when you're a researcher, publishing papers, IP, all that sort of stuff, that is, you know, that's kind of the feathers in the caps that you like to wear. But it helps us in terms of, I guess, our credibility. It helps us to support the products and support some of the applications that we, I guess, as a commercial organization, say that they can actually perform. I mean, I think that's really important. It's something that, you know, I would say to help people in terms of their business case decisions to, in an environment where validating equipment, validating techniques, validating processes is absolutely front and center, being able to leverage things like this, bits of research that have been done, can only be a positive step. So I guess it benefits everyone, really. But
it does. I mean, it obviously, I think this is great because it just embarks in a new area in document analysis, and it opens the door to other things. And, you know, you've talked about future work here right in the paper, right? So you're talking about, you know, interference of stroke direction of the crossing intersection. So what would you like to see happen there? Like, what kind of studies are you thinking about there?
Loads of things. I mean, we've got, there is just so many, I mean, it's different pen types, different paper types. When you have different inks as well, then you have different optical properties of those particular inks. So does that change the ability of one particular process over the other? We've also kind of thought about things where you've got stamps, for example, like passport stamps, when they're above or below different inks, then that all comes into the equation. But I think one of the key things from this piece of work is, you know, it's a pilot study, it's a proof of concept. There are lots of pilot studies and proof of concept publications that are out there. And one of the things that I guess is a frustration, not just for me, but pretty much everybody that I guess works in the research environment, is that it's going from that proof of concept to exploitation, and that's the big jump that needs to happen. So there are some things that we talk about here in the future work whereby we want to try and do double blind studies, we want to try and have a wider range of donors, we want to try it out on age samples, because naturally, you know, things like that will have an effect on the plumpness of the fibers in the particular document. So there's a whole range of things and we are just scratching the surface with this, but you know, it's an absolutely crucial step in the right direction for us to, I guess, to really develop things further as I guess the market requires it to do so.
Yeah. And I'm curious about, because you say that the VSC8000 is semi-quantitative, but you do get measurements from it.
Yep. You can get measurements from it. We can do sort of measurements on the XY, you know, and so we can calibrate in that respect. We have a spectrophotometer in there as well, so we can do measurements of absorption and reflectance as well. It's the semi quantification is largely to do with the Z axis in terms of getting that depth measurement, and that's where we, you know, that's why we use the gel site to kind of confirm.
Okay, great. Yeah, awesome. I think it's a wonderful area, and I always thought that there was definitely some utility in using 3D, you know, 3D technologies in this particular area. But as I always said, I usually know where the difficulty is, and that is trying to find the correct technique and exploring now all these different areas that you mentioned, right? That's going to take quite a bit of work, you know, the blind testing and everything else. But now do you partner at all with universities and other institutions, like to do research and things like that? Do people come to you sometimes?
We, We try to get involved as much as possible. We have a PhD project on at the minute with a university not too far from us, and that's loosely related to QDE examination actually. But we have relationships with probably another half dozen universities in the UK, police forces. We try and engage in some research projects where possible as well. We appreciate and we respect that there needs to be impartiality and certainly from the public sector, and that's one of the reasons why we like to publish what we do, because the whole point of publishing work is that it's transparent, it is impartial, it's peer reviewed, and it's for the benefit of the wider community. So yeah, absolutely, we relish the opportunity to work with third parties and kind of harness some of their skills to along with ours and kind of collectively move things forward. I'm more than happy to hear from anyone that has any suggestions.
Just one question here actually from Muntawakila Amadu. He's asking about product support and maintenance repair. Can you talk briefly on that? And I think he means for Foster and Freeman, not for Gelsite. Yeah. So
I can do. I mean, we support our products basically as long as we can. I mean, we're like many other manufacturers. We have a product roadmap. We can support products that are out in field as long as we can get the parts that are required and what have you. But fundamentally, I think one of the things that we're well known for is that robustness of product, and also our customer support in terms of our product training and our applications training. So generally speaking, when we supply a product, we offer training along with that, and we will have one of our application specialists who are, as the name suggests, they are specialists in that particular product application. They will travel out to customer sites and do one-on-one training, group training. We've obviously now started doing online training, so we can do a hybrid kind of training program as well. We're in the process of developing e-learning platforms as well, which I think is another really, really important tool. People want to be able to have data, information, all of that sort of stuff available when they need it rather than on a schedule that suits everyone. So having an e-learning platform is really important for us as well. So there's a huge amount of work that's gone into developing that. So our customer support is very good. I would say that, but it is, it genuinely is. And we have a distribution network now. We supply products into over 140 countries worldwide. And the UK is probably about 5-8% of what we do. America, North America, Canada, it's a huge market for us. We have distribution partners. We have our head office is in the UK. We also have a facility in Virginia in the United States. They've been there for about 20 years now. We have a new office it's about 3 or 4 years old in Germany. And we have a more recent office that we opened in the Netherlands as well. So we're starting to branch out a little bit in terms of our physical presence, but we generally have a distribution network all around the world.
If I want to, I'm just putting up the website here, but if anyone goes to fosterfreeman.com, you'll see that there's a contact area there. So Roberto, if somebody wants to get a hold of you or something like that, that's one way, I guess, through the website.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And also I've got, I asked you about this before, but Roberto is also on LinkedIn. He posts every now and then. In fact, that's how I saw the paper that you had posted earlier. So you can always reach out to him there as well. Roberto, look, we're getting on in time. I want to say thank you so much. I think it's really exciting research, embarking in these new areas. And I know there's always a lot of work to do. Sometimes it's overwhelming, but hopefully, you get some help from other parties.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we're never short of ideas. It's getting them done. That's always a challenge.
Yeah, for sure.
It's been great, Eugene. Honestly, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk. And thanks for everyone for dialing in and positive comments I can see coming in the comment sections.
Yeah, definitely. People from all over the place. We got Romania, we've got Turkey, we've got Argentina, we've got the United States, we got Canada.
Well, we're going viral, Eugene.
Hey, we're global. We go global here, so it's all good. Hey, listen, do me a favor. Hang back and I'll come chat with you just a bit.
No worries.
All right, cheers. Yeah, thanks everyone. I want to wish you all the best and have a happy Thursday. Bye-bye.